You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Lead out men once again for Adam Blythe, the sixth and final interview by Adam Blythe for the Cycling Podcast, at least the final one of this first series. And who's the special guest today, Lionel?
Well, before I reveal that, I'm a bit concerned if we're the people that Adam is relying on as lead out men.
Leading him out the back.
Exactly, yeah. Leading him to the team car at the feed zone for an early abandon. Today's guest is Thomas de Gendt, Belgian rider who finished on the podium at the 2012 Giro d'Italia. Remember, came pretty close to winning that in the final mountain stages. It was almost pulled off a shock win, it would have been, I guess. And we thought at that stage, well, is this the next big Belgian Grand Tour contender? But he has evolved into a breakaway specialist, as we'll hear in the interview, him talking about his preference for getting in the breaks and his success rate. He's frequently in the breaks and has, well, I'd say better than even success. This year he won the first stage of the Volta a Catalunya with a break. You may remember he won the stage of the Tour de France on Mont Ventoux, which was overshadowed really in the end, because it was the day when Chris Froome came to grief and ended up running up the hill without his bike. That was a little bit unfortunate for.
It also only finished halfway up Mont Ventoux, remember, with the strong.
That's right, it did. Yeah, but he's also won stages, a stage in the Vuelta, and this year de Gendt is going to follow in the wheel tracks of his Lotto Soudal teammate Adam Hansen, who made a habit of riding all three Grand Tours in the same season, and de Gendt is going to attempt that this season. So he's on the start list for the Giro d'Italia. And, well, Adam and Thomas are both riding the Tour of Romandy in Switzerland at the moment, and this interview took place, I think, in their hotel room after the prologue time trial.
Did indeed. We must apologise for having skipped a week last week with the Adam Blythe interviews. There was a little technical problem with the interview that Adam did conduct last week, and we weren't able to rectify that in time. But de Gendt is somebody who a lot of you have been asking for him to interview. Their Lotto Soudal teammates, of course. He's one of the more interesting characters in the peloton, really. A real one-off, one of a kind, isn't he? There aren't many riders with his particular skill set and a few quirks as well. You know, he loves stage races. He's Belgian, but we don't see much of him in the classics at all. So really looking forward to listening to this chat between Adam and Thomas de Gendt. Before we cross over to Switzerland to hear that and their hotel room, must say a big thanks to our headline sponsors, Rafa. Rafa support all the Cycling Podcast output throughout the year. Check out the new Nelson Vales range of clothing from Rafa. Very striking garments dedicated to and inspired by the cheetah, the Olympic silver medalist in 1984 in the sprint. He'd been a courier not long before that. Nelson Vales, a very interesting guy. Also have a look at the Rafa Roadmap, which is Rafa's analysis of some of the challenges facing professional cycling and their ideas about how it might be better for teams, riders, race organisers and, of course, fans. You'll find some of the roadmap at rafa.cc. It's also being serialised at velonews.com. And just before we hear the interview, a warning that there is some bad language in this episode. So if you're listening with young kids, maybe cover their ears or listen later. So without further ado, let's cross over to Switzerland and Adam Blythe in conversation with Thomas de Gendt.
You are listening to a special episode of the Cycling Podcast. Adam Blythe interviews.
First of all, apologies, everyone. I've been a bit quiet trying to get podcasts done. Thomas has been hiding in a cupboard. He wouldn't let me do it. So I finally got hold of him. We've got Thomas de Gendt today. He's not really been hiding in a cupboard, but yeah, I've not had time to do a podcast. So here we are in Romandy now, first day done, just on the prologue. I was good until the intermediate. I tried to beat Thomas at the intermediate point and I didn't beat him. He still beat me by 2 seconds and then put another further 25 seconds into me after that.
I don't know. Bastard. I haven't seen the finished results.
Yeah, so Thomas was 22nd? 22nd. I think I was 100 and something. So in the top 20 of the last 20. And Victor crashed. Not good, but yeah. Anyway, enough of that. So today I've got, as I said a minute ago, but you all know him. He's a famous rider, famous for getting in the breakaways and all-round good guy. So Thomas De Gendt, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing very well. We are very close to the Giro, the first big goal, so looking forward to it. And the feeling is good, so I'm in a positive mood for the moment.
Good. That's good to hear. I'm going to jump straight into it, mate, and ask about the Giro. You've got a lot of history with the Giro. Well, not a lot of history. You've only done it twice.
Yeah, only twice.
But you almost won it. Very close.
It was, I think, 1:36 from the first position, so it's nothing.
Yeah, it's really not. After 3 weeks, it's nothing yet. And you look in this Giro, you're looking skinny. You got on the scales earlier and you were like, oh la la, it's good for you. So you're obviously in good shape, you're skinny. Are you looking to do a repeat better, hopefully?
No, no, not really a repeat of the GC, but... I wanted to be skinny just to stay ahead of the problems with the weight. As you know, we went to Tour Down Under and we did a lot of restaurants and I gained a bit of kilos there. So I had to lose that weight again. And I needed some help from a professional, a nutritionist, Julie. And she helped me lose that weight. So now I'm very skinny.
Yeah, you look good. But I don't think we didn't eat out that much. Well, we did eat out quite a lot, but it was good food.
It was good food, but still I gained 3 kilos, which was probably 2 kilos of fat and 1 kilo of muscle. So
I blame Valgeren because he kept asking us to go for dinner. Yeah. Valgeren and sushi train.
The chuletas got me.
Yeah, exactly.
And the sushi also.
Yeah, the sushi was good though. So back onto Giro, what's your goals for it? You've got 3 Grand Tours this year. You're not looking to do GC, well, maybe, you never know.
So. No, GC is something that's finished for me. I did it once, I tried it a second time in the Tour, and after 3 days I wasn't more than half an hour. So I don't like the stress of the GC. I don't like to be up. Front in the peloton the whole time and fighting for every second. So GC is finished, but I'm looking to win a stage. I think that's a nice objective.
Yeah.
Try to win a stage, not only Giro, but just in one of the 3 Grand Tours. If you can win a stage in a Grand Tour in your season, then your season is...
It's a good season, yeah.
It's gone very well.
So you want to win it in Giro. You're doing Giro Tour Vuelta this year.
Yeah.
You want to win a stage in...
One of the three, at least, if it's possible, a second one somewhere. But it's not really a goal to only do it in a Giro, but it would be nice if you do it in a Giro already, then you're safe for the rest of the season.
Yeah, but if you could pick one, you'd pick the Tour, or not?
Because the Tour is the most important one also for the sponsors.
Yeah.
Already 2 years in a row, we didn't win a stage in the Tour. And then you see at the final dinner with the... sponsors that they are all a bit disappointed about happened. Because 1 year we won 4 stages with Greipel. So if we don't win a stage in the Tour this year, that would be a major letdown to the sponsors. So, yeah. But I don't think we won't win a stage. We have Caleb now and he is eager to go for a stage win.
I think so,
If I can win one in the Giro, the pressure is already off.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what... For me, the way that you invite races, you're a little bit like, for me, you're like Cummings, but like a newer Cummings, you know? You're really intelligent, but the way you do it is just out of pure, just racing. You want to go as hard as you can for as long as you can.
Yeah.
And you look, but you love to do it, don't you? You love to see people suffer. You love to get people on. I remember when we were in Australia and we went training and we did the first hour and we had like 300 watt average. And I could see in your face, you saw I was suffering. You were like, unlucky. But that's how you race as well. Yeah. You just love to kill people.
Yeah, but it's easier to make you suffer on the climb than the rest of the bunch, but still. That's true.
It's so true. That's why I'm laughing.
Yeah, but it's something that I like to do just to go full and try to win stages like this. Because it's a nice way to race. People like to watch it like this. And yeah.
What's crazy is how successful you are at it. It's not you get a fluke win that can do something like that. Like that guy that you see the Tour of Yorkshire last year. There's a guy that rode off the final day, a French guy from Cofidis.
Yeah.
And he's not really done anything like that since. But you'll do this 4 times a year probably.
2 times a year. I win two races every year. More or less, yeah. And that's enough. I want to win more, but it's only 2 times out of the 26 times that I'm in a break that I win. So my success rate is not that high compared to the times I go in the break. But the times I go to the finish, then my success rate is a bit higher.
Yeah, which is good.
Very good. I have a nose for winning. When I come to the position of winning, but still you need to have the legs, and sometimes you still have somebody with you that is faster or stronger.
Yeah.
And then they win and I come second or third or fourth or something.
Good example was that was Paris-Nice.
Yeah.
Magnus.
He was faster, so
yeah.
Then he wins.
But it's not like he's faster, but you still held him at the same amount of time. He is faster, obviously. But it's not like you can't do a good sprint also.
No, I can do a good sprint, but not against somebody who wins bunch sprints in the Vuelta. He wins 2 stages, so I'm fast, but not that fast. But I wanted to have a good chance for the win. So I wanted to do the sprint from third position, the final 300 meters. Then I have a good chance, but still he would have beaten me. But at least I would have a fair chance of winning, and now he attacked. It's not nice of him.
Bastard. Oh dear. But you got your own back in an impressive way, a race that a lot of us watched on TV, and we were all sort of going, this is typical Thomas, Catalonia. You rode away on the first day, and you didn't just ride away, you were in a break with 8 guys. Or 6?
6 or 7 or 8. 6, I think.
And you went with 60k to go solo.
Yeah.
But what's going through your head?
Well, we made a plan the day before and we looked at the profile of the race. And it's Catalunya is a hard race. But this finish typically is a sprint finish, but always with the strongest sprinters, the ones that can climb, Michael Matthews. But also Greipel is there. And it's the first day, so it's always kind of, there's no leader yet, so there's not really a team that wants to ride. All the sprinters, and you don't know how strong the other sprinters are, so you don't want your team to ride too soon. So it's always like a strange day for the chase. So we picked that day as the best day, looked at the profile. I said, if I can get to the top of the climb, with 3.5 minutes advantage, then they won't catch me back, because then it was all downhill, flat, only a small climb. And I went solo that early because the peloton got back at, I think, 2:30 at the foot of that climb. So I had to go a bit faster on the second last climb than I would go. And it was with Mate that could follow me, and then... And when I saw that he couldn't really follow anymore, I attacked
him. No, but there's a story about this. The stupid thing is with this story is that when Thomas says, I needed to go a bit faster, everyone in the break's going, oh, we're going to be caught soon. We're like, that's it, we're done. You're going, I can stay away. We just need to go a little bit faster. And that's the crazy thing in your head. And you told me the story about, what was it, Matty, the guy you were with. And he was saying, can I sit on your wheel? Or can I sit on your wheel? You tell the story, because it's a better story.
No, we had this climb pretty steep climb, and I just went full on this climb, and if the bunch wants to go faster, they drop the sprinter, so they won't do it. So I thought I can get 1 minute on this part of the track. And Matti was in the wheel. He was really suffering, I could see. And there is a small plateau on this first climb, and he was still staying in the wheel, and he said, if you let me recover a few kilometers, then I can take a few turns again. And I said to him, but the next climb we will go full. And, and he had... And I saw the look on his face, like, yeah, he was already suffering, so I knew he was done. And so, and then, yeah, I attacked him a few kilometers after that.
Yeah, but the best way you attacked him, you say, I'll just do one pull, and then he did one pull, and then you attacked him.
Yeah, I was riding my pace. It was 400 watts. It's like a climb 6-7 kilometers long, so yeah. I wanted to do 400 watts, and I can hold this like for half an hour. And I asked him to just do one pull, and the speed dropped, and I was only driving 300 watts in the wheel, and I saw that he was suffering. So it was not really the only thing that I could do, or it was like a sandbag backpack the whole climb, and he would be on the wheel, and then you give somebody a free ride to the finish in that way. But now I could only, when I'm alone, I only have to take care of myself, and I just need to ride my own pace, and I don't have to look to anybody. So that's easier.
Easier. For in anyone else's book, that's not easier. It's only you that it's easier for.
Yeah, but then you're from the moment you're alone, you just have to ride your own pace, and then go as fast as you want.
You make it sound so simple. Is that the fact that 2 minutes ago you just said, my pace is 400 watts for half an hour, which is ridiculous, because there's not many people that can do 400 watts for half an hour, especially after being in the break for 120k before.
That point, 120.
Not many people can do it. I can't do it if I go out the door and do it. So I think that's what's more impressive, the way that you can do these numbers. And we don't really talk about numbers. I like to talk about what your records are, because they're stupid. And it's always at the start of a race up a climb.
Yeah.
Because you like to start the races at the back. This is the weird thing with Thomas De Gendt, ladies and gentlemen, and this is why he's so good, is that Thomas told me in Australia, in the tours, he will always start at the back, so he can see people coming back, suffering, and then be like, one less. And then by the time he gets to the front, there's probably only like 60 guys left, and then he'll start attacking. And it, for me, I'll be like, 60 guys, that's good, I'm happy in this group. But you're like, nah, I can make this a lot harder already.
But the thing is, with a start uphill, the guys in the front, they are attacking, and especially in the Tour, then it's mostly Team Sky who is sort of controlling. They take a pace that they want, and everybody who wants to go faster is attacking. And when I start in the back, I can pass riders, and it's good for the morale, and I see sprinters suffering. And then by the time I get to the front, there is most of the time already 10 guys gone, but it's only 10, 20 seconds. And then that's the point where nobody wants to attack anymore. And then I just ride to the first group because I want to go faster, and they let me go. So that's...
I don't think they let you go, mate. I think you just go and that's it.
Team Sky lets me go, and the rest is already tired. But because you have like the tempo of moving up, you're already riding that pace for some time. So you know this is the pace I need to do to get away from them, and then you just keep on riding the same pace.
But don't you think if you started at the front, and then we were easy, and then you were like, right.
But then they are in the wheel. That's a problem. Then they are in the wheel, and they're still fresh. Sometimes I start in the front, and then... I try to do the same, and then we also ride away. So it's just sometimes it's easier like this.
Depends.
How the
there's no better the feeling. Though. I agree with you. There's no better feeling. It doesn't happen to me often. Is when you're doing a climb and people are dropping, and you're still going forward. You're like, yeah. Happened to me. Happened. It's probably about 4 times it's happened in my career. But yeah, it's I understand it.
All on the same climb.
All on the same climb. Yeah. I love Thomas De Gendt. So moving on from Romandy this year, we've got the Giro and then the Tour. Tour, do you like it? Is it your favourite race out of the three Grand Tours? Or?
No, it's too stressful. It's the first 10 days, they are so much stress, crashes, everybody's still fresh. There is a lot of wind most of the times. And usually I go there with the sprinter, so I have to work or do something crazy in the front of the bunch where I don't want to be. So that's the problem. But I like it after the first rest day. Then it's better.
Yeah. It sounds ridiculous, but it's like a lot of people say in a Grand Tour, after the first rest day, the real race starts, which is ridiculous.
But then there are also already time gaps. In the first week, a lot of guys think that they still can take the yellow jersey by going in the attack or something. But
do you think that's more... I think there's less of that. I've not done a Grand Tour in a while, but I think there's less of that now than there was like 6 years ago. 6 years ago, I felt like there was a lot of people still pushing always. But now I feel like there's a lot of people that are like, right, I've done my job. I've got 10K to go. True. I can sit up now. So it's like a lot less stressful.
Still, the first 40 will go. We'll keep pushing.
Yeah.
If you're still in the top 40, you still keep pushing. But it's more that the domestiques, once they did their job, the guys that can still climb a little bit, once they did their job, they let go.
Yeah, which is, I think it's better now, you do your job and then you get out of the way, rather than try and cause more.
They are getting smarter, they know tomorrow is another day, I have to do this job again. If I keep pushing 350 watts on this climb for the next 15 kilometers, then they get a bit more tired.
But how ridiculous is this that it's taken them until 2019 to realise it?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, interrupting this week's Adam Blythe interview to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by The Week. Now, if you don't know what The Week is, it's basically a news filter. It pulls together stories from a range of different sources, newspapers and magazines, and certainly from the few weeks that I've been reading The Week, it's exposed me to stories that I wouldn't have seen if I'd just observed my ordinary reading habits online and in print. Richard, you've been having a look through The Week. What's caught your eye?
Well, a story with a connection to cycling, because McLaren, of course, are involved with the Bahrain Merida team and are rumoured to be stepping up their involvement. But they also produce cars, of course, quite good cars. And they're about to launch a new Grand Tourer, which has been spotted being tested on roads in Spain. You mentioned the range of publications in The Week. I mean, this story draws on stories in Autocar, Motor Trend and Piston Heads, which is a publication I confess I hadn't heard of. And I was very struck by how the car looks, but actually that's the camouflage wrap around it. But yeah, camouflage. I know you'll be wondering how much this car costs, Lionel. £152,300 it will cost.
I'm not going to live in it, Richard.
Or $200,000. Wow. So yeah, and deliveries should begin in either July or August. Very nice car. Not a story I would have seen had I not been flicking through The Week. So it's a good example of I was interested in it from the cycling point of view, but it's a very lovely looking car with very powerful 4-litre V8 engines, which I know you know all about.
The other thing about The Week is that a lot of the stories are really quite short, so you can really rattle through and read an awful lot in quite a short period of time. It's a very economical way to absorb a lot of news, with quite a lot of the stories are concise summaries. So I've certainly enjoyed that about it, and you can try it for free too, listeners. If you want to join the 350,000 people who trust The Week as their essential curated news source, try it yourself with the first 6 issues completely free. So to get 6 issues delivered to you, go to theweek.co.uk/offer. And then when you need to put in the offer code, put in the word cycling. That's theweek.co.uk/offer. And the offer code is cycling.
This episode is also supported by the British Heart Foundation, who are the headline sponsor of the London to Brighton bike ride, which we're all going to be taking part in next month.
We are indeed. Next month already. Yes, it's June the 16th, isn't it? Sunday, June the 16th. I've been training hard, Richard. I've been in the Ardennes, riding a big section of the Liège-Bastogne-Liège course.
Yeah, I was listening to your heavy breathing earlier today.
In the Ardennes special episode. Yes, well, you can tell I'm getting into shape pretty quickly for this.
It was good for the morale, I must say.
Well, you've cracked already because you're not happy with our 6 a.m. start time. So I've got to negotiate that with the organisers because you're too soft to start at 6 in the morning.
No, I'm driving back from the women's tour the previous evening and it's a 5-hour drive and we'll get back late, so would rather not have a 6 a.m. start if that's possible. If you're listening,
if we're setting off late, we'll be taking a nice leisurely trip down to the coast in Brighton. Really looking forward to this ride. It's 54 miles long. It's 17 miles of it are on completely closed roads, and it goes over Ditchling Beacon. The Tour de France tackled that in 1994. I'm looking forward to the best bit. Will be arriving at the seaside and having some fish and chips, I expect. You know, that's the purpose of the journey. The purpose of the journey is also to raise money for the British Heart Foundation's research into heart and circulatory diseases, which are responsible for 1 in 4 deaths in the UK. So it's a ride for a great cause, and it's a really sociable day out. And we've put together a team. If you'd like to sponsor us, please do sponsor us, whether for a small amount, every little helps. Go to justgiving.com/the-cycling-podcast. We've raised over £1,000 so far. We'd like to make that a lot more by the middle of June. And if you'd like to ride the event yourself, you can get £5 off the entry fee by going to bhf.org.uk/L2B2019 and entering the code Brighton5. That's Brighton and the number 5. We'll see you on the beach.
See you on the start line, Lionel.
So you started professional as well. Sorry, it's a big jump. You started professional. We had a little, you said earlier, 2009.
Yeah.
You started with Topsport Vlaanderen for 3 years?
2 years.
2 years. And then Vakansoleil?
3 years.
3 years. 1 year at
Quickstep.
1 year at Quickstep. So this is what I want to ask you about. Normally, everyone that goes to Quickstep, they get 10 times better and they win like 50 races a year. Everyone does. And you went, and you told me this in Down Under, and I had no idea you went to Quickstep for a year. What happened? sorry, not what happened, but...
No, what happened, it's Quickstep is a good team,
yeah.
Really good team. And if you look at the riders that were in that team in 2014, and then you know that Thomas de Gendt is one of the lesser riders.
Yeah.
So... That's what happened. There were always riders in the team that were better, and I had to do my job as a domestique for them.
Yeah.
So that's what happened for most of the year. And then,
who was the GC guy then in the team? Rigo.
Oran.
Okay.
Oran was a GC guy, but we had Koski and Trentin, all these guys. Bono was still there.
Well, it was a good team then in that year. Holy shit.
Really, you should look up the names of that year. It's Tony Martin, Alaphilippe. They were all there.
Wow.
They were still young. Alaphilippe and those guys, they were still young.
He was a stagiaire in 2014, I think, no?
13. 14, he was already professional, also Vakos.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so
yeah.
it was a really good team. And then it's normal that you have to go.
Yeah, of course. Especially with these guys. Well, if you look back now, if you take you and the rest of the guys like you mentioned and put them in another team again, well, it would be a strong tour team.
Yeah.
Really strong.
Yeah, Wout Poels was also still there. So if you...
Wout Poels was in Quickstep?
Also 1 year.
Oh, yeah? The same year?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Being in Quickstep is pretty much... I guess when Uran was there, it wasn't so much... It was more of a GC team. And was that your role? Or were you looking towards classics and things like this more?
No, on training camp they already said that I would be in the Giro team to support Rigoberto. And he got second in GC, so I did my job.
Oh, that's good, yeah.
And I did not really do any classics. And they told me that I could do the Giro and the Vuelta normally. And maybe if the Giro was really, really good, then I could do the Tour. I was in the pre-selection for the Tour, but after the Giro, they only let me do like 12 races. So I had 64 races, I think, that year. So they took me off the race program after the Giro.
Why?
I don't know why. I did national championships, and then they sent me to altitude camp in Livigno. I did a tour of Poland, and then Hamburg, Plouay, Lichtervelde, and that's it.
Really? Well, that is a quiet program.
Yeah, I only could do 4 or 5 races extra in October because Ilio Kersa broke one of his bones, and that's why I could do still Franco-Belge.
That's a nice race.
It's really nice. Good winners, only good ones.
Only good winners in that race. Oh, thanks, Thomas De Gendt, giving me a compliment.
I was there that year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was a good year, wasn't it? It was a hard year.
Yeah, I know.
Fuglsang and Sepp van Marck, second and third.
It's not a bad top three.
Yeah. They progressed a lot quicker than I did. I'm still building. So not doing any classics, especially as you're a Belgian and on a Belgian team, even Quickstep and a Belgian team now, do you not enjoy them? I asked you about Roubaix. I think you've done Roubaix once, Flanders once.
I think Flanders twice. And then Roubaix once. Milan Sanremo also once.
It's not something you enjoy doing, or you just...
I think they have better guys in the team for these races. I did... Liège and Flèche Wallonne. I did these races until 2 years ago, but then my program got a bit, it got a bit too much with Paris-Nice and then Catalunya, Romandie and Pays Basque. I did all these races, and if you do the classics also, then it just got a bit too much.
Yeah, of course.
And I would only be a domestique in these races, so. They also have other riders for this.
Yeah.
So since last year, I stopped doing them, and I won a stage here in Romandy. And the other years before, I was always already a bit tired.
Yeah.
And I could not really do a result here. And then last year, I was still really good. So I said from now on, I don't do any classics anymore.
And will you do them again or not? Because you, like you said then, you talked about being a domestique in the classics. When you go into the Grand Tours, unless this team gets a GC guy, then you almost have a free roll. You have to ride some days for Caleb and everything. But is that something you look at in this team, which while you've stayed, that you have this free roll in the, not really a free roll, but a role where you can really show Thomas De Gendt?
Yeah, in the classics, they also want to send me in the attack, which is my specialty, but. In the classic, you only have one chance to go in the attack, and the attacks never stick to the finish. And in the Grand Tour, you always have 3 or 4 attacks that go to the finish. So I have 4 chances if I'm in, and that's why the team wants me to go to the Grand Tour for these 4 stages that I have a chance. They have a sprinter for the sprint stages. They have Tisch for the climbs, also Björk for the short steep ones, and then they still have 4 days. Of the attack days where everybody knows they will.
Everyone knows Thomas De Gendt's going in the break.
Everybody knows that the winner will be from an attack, so they want to have a chance there also.
Yeah,
but this year, probably Tim Wellens, Thijs Benoot will go to the tour.
Yeah,
so maybe in some of these days I will still have a domestique role for them.
Yeah,
Tim Wellens has more chance of winning than I do. But still, I will have a free role, and in the classics, I will only be a domestique. But we have a lot of other riders that can do the same role,
and then you
can save me for these races.
Yeah, so it's not something you'll look the way if you keep going the way you are, because you're 32 now.
Yeah,
you won't do any more classics.
No, if they really want me to do them, then I will do them. But
Flemish ones or Ardennes?
Ardennes, Flemish ones. I live in between the cobbles, and I do the cobblestones sometimes in training, and I don't like them.
Nobody likes them, mate. The horrible thing. Thomas is just looking at his Twitter following. That's a good question, actually. You on Twitter. Sorry, I've got another question here. But you on Twitter, you love Twitter. Well, you don't love it, but you always seem to be on there cracking jokes and everything. And after spending a little bit of time with you in Down Under especially, I didn't really... If you don't know Thomas, I'd say you think you're quite quiet, quite shy, reserved. And then once you get to know him, it's like a joke a minute. And in the room, you have music on full gas every night until about 11, and then you go to sleep. Is this what you like at home, or?
No, at home I don't put on music. But I like to joke, and some of them are really good, and other jokes are a bit worse.
80% of jokes are worse.
But still, you have a laugh, and it's better to be a bit funnier than always serious. I am a shy person, but it's once I get to know somebody, then I'm a bit looser.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing it, looser. And how did you actually start cycling then? Because you've got a big family. You got
four siblings, three brothers and one sister. And my oldest brother, he was a cyclist, more or less. He did some cycling, and he was a cyclocross rider, and he did some mountain bike racing, but he never won a race. Well, he did one time, but he actually was already in the next category.
Yeah.
It's the time when you change category on the day of your birthday.
Yeah.
And they thought he was still 17 while he was already 18 for 2 weeks. So he won in the 17 as a 17-year-old, but actually he was already 18, so technically he didn't win.
Fair enough.
I was always...
You're not jealous about that?
He was... every weekend we went out and to a race, cyclocross race or something, and I really loved it. I was 4, 5, 6 years old.
Yeah.
The years that he raced, and I really loved it. And once we got home the day after, I was riding on this little BMX bike with like a really,
round handlebars.
Yeah.
Like a race bike.
Like a race bike. And I just went in the garden, always full for 3-4 hours. Just, do the race again. And once I was old enough to start racing myself, I started racing.
Yeah.
And I was 10 years old when I did my first race. And from then on, I think I did one race every weekend.
Oh, really? So now you're racing less?
Yeah. No, in the winter, except the winter, but from February till October, I always have raced.
Always racing.
Yeah.
Nice. And then you went from doing all that, and this is where we have a similar growing up. We both went into the feeder team for Lotto, and you went in there for 2 years.
Three.
Were you with Kurt?
Yeah. I was 2 years with Kurt, and then 1 year when it was still Unibet Davo.
Okay,
then it was the younger team of the Unibet team.
Yeah. And then it changed over to Lotto.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that. So they were the Unibet first, and then the ownership changed to Lotto.
First it was a normal Continental team, then they were the younger team of Unibet for 1 year, I think. And then it went to a normal Continental team again.
Yeah.
And then the year after I left, they became the younger team of Lotto.
Right. So for you that don't know, is that the young Lotto team has been around a long time, but it just selects like young talent that are living in Belgium or racing in Belgium. And I went through there, and I mentioned Kurt van der Wouwer, who's also a director on the team we're both in now, in the big Lotto team. But he was the DS when we were growing up. So it's nice to see that it works. And on the training camp this year, they said how many riders have been through the development team. And you put your hands up, and there must have been 70% of that room that put their hands up.
Most of the Belgian riders.
Yeah.
Most of the Belgian riders, some foreign riders. James Shaw, that has left the team, was also one of the riders.
He's still wearing Lotto Soudal gloves in his other team.
So he still has a...
passion for Lotto. Yeah, he's got some memories.
No, but there are a lot of riders. Also Tim Tisch, most of the good guys. Björk Harm, Victor also, I think.
Oh, yeah? I didn't know Victor.
I think Victor was also 1 year at the younger team, and then he went to Topsport.
Yeah.
So a lot of riders.
It's good. Are you, do you know why they come through the team? Do you think it's because it's it's not easier?
No, but when I was an under 23 rider, and it was still Davo, called Davo.
Yeah.
And then it was one of the three best teams of Belgium. So yeah. that was one of the teams that you wanted to be in. It was either that one or Young Vlaanderen was the like younger team of Top Sport, and then Beveren 2000 was
Beveren,
the
yeah.
younger team of Quickstep. So you always wanted to be in one of those three teams. And Beveren 2000 stopped. Young Vlaanderen also stopped. So
yeah,
still one left. There are a lot of good teams still in Belgium, but Davo is one of the oldest, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And there's still riders English. I think there's one English rider in there now. I can't be sure. You guys will correct me probably, but yeah, it's a great way to get into professional ranks, and I think a great way to start riding. Sorry, this has gone off subject from Thomas again, but
but they still have a good program. Also, that's also important. They have a really nice program outside of Belgium.
So I remember I thought I saw you. I asked you this question about the lightweights. So I thought I saw Thomas when I was. I think it's when I was first year amateur. I rode for a small team, not Davo, and I did a race in the Ardennes, and you were doing it, and Ben Hermans, but I got you and Ben Hermans mixed up.
Yep.
Because Ben Hermans had lightweights, and he rode off solo, but you didn't have lightweights, and I thought you were him. And when
I
you told...
I was third.
If you had lightweights, you'd have probably won.
No, because it was a teammate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we were teammates.
Oh, shit.
So we got first and third, I think. Was Circuit de Wallonie.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I remember it.
With the steep climb at the end.
Yeah, I got dropped, and it was a really hot day.
That I don't remember, but I know where it was.
I got dropped. I was only a first year. It's like a tradition here with me getting dropped on climbs.
Yeah.
One day.
It's a hobby.
Yes, it's a great hobby. Thanks, mate. There's a little bit of Thomas de Gent humour for you. But that's it, I think. There's not much more to... Well, there is probably a lot more I can ask, but we're going to get off to bed now because we've got another race tomorrow. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you've enjoyed it, Thomas. There's not been a lot of personal questions, which I don't want to ask you.
No worries.
Thanks.
That's nice.
Thanks for coming, guys. See you later.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and their support of you, the listeners, through the 25% discount, which you can get by putting in the code SISCP25 at the checkout at scienceandsport.com when you go to buy all your gels, bars and drinks. Put in the code SISCP25 and that will get you a 25% discount. Thank you once again to Science and Sport. And thank you to Adam Blythe and Thomas de Gent. A very relaxed chat between the pair of them, similar in a way to the earlier one in the series with Tesh Benoit, when it sounded like they were just kind of shooting the breeze in their hotel room after riding the opening stage of the prologue of the Tour de Romandie. And you know, one of the things that I thought was very interesting there was something that Adam asked De Gent about, which is, you know, he's a very, very funny guy on social media. And sometimes he can present a slightly sort of dour personality in interviews and so on, which doesn't necessarily reflect his, you know, clearly his sense of humour. And I thought that was really interesting. Point made by Adam that he's clearly quite shy when you get to know him, but once you do get to know De Gent with, you know, as teammates like Adam clearly have, that's when he reveals his sense of humour.
Yeah, I think from my point of view as somebody, we often have to go and interview riders and strike up that kind of rapport quite quickly. And I remember being at the Lotto Soudal training camp in Mallorca a couple of Christmases ago and having sort of 20-25 minutes with De Gent, and felt a bit like after a quarter of an hour or so, I felt like I was just about starting to warm him up a bit, and then our time was beginning to run out. And I think the one thing that these Adam Blythe interviews have all had in common is that there's an instant rapport and kind of a peer-to-peer respect between the two people having a conversation that we can't really replicate. And so you get a very different sense of someone's personality and a much more relaxed and I think in some ways revealing portrait of the person. So that's what I've enjoyed most about this series, and probably this one achieved that more than the others. So it was worth waiting the week for.
Oh, definitely. It's little details, isn't it? Like the confession about the extra pounds gained from eating sushi in Australia, not something he would necessarily volunteer to a journalist. Or the fact that, you know, the last couple of Tours de France have been very difficult for Lotto Soudal, and when you get to the end of the race and you sit down with the sponsors and they're not happy, a sense of that tension that is always there, again, not often revealed to us, but in conversation with a teammate, it is. And those little details are interesting. And
well, it paints a picture, doesn't it? I mean, can you imagine you slogged yourself around France for 3,500 kilometres, and then the sponsors, who are effectively everyone is acutely aware in a cycling team that they're the ones, you know, putting the whole show on the road. The payback is result still, particularly in a kind of quite traditional team as Lotto Soudal, you know, results equal exposure equals smiles on the faces of the sponsors. And just imagining that sense, if you're not 100% happy with your own results or performances, the sort of awkwardness of having to having to mix and almost, I guess, being almost apologetic for not having delivered, that must be quite a tension that they could do without at the end of a 3-week grand tour. But that's part of the job, part of the business.
Yeah, I didn't pick up the sense that there was necessarily pressure, more a feeling maybe that the riders have of not having done their jobs as well as they could have done, or not having had the luck to win a stage, or just to be able to give the sponsors something, I guess, to say, to thank them for their investment in the team. So, yeah, I mean, as I say, an interesting guy. Already had a good season, Thomas de Gent, with his win in Catalonia. I was watching Tour de Romandie stage one today, and he was in a very select lead group, and I mentioned at the start, you know, how much of a one-off De Gent is. You know, you look at the company he's keeping there on quite a tough stage, and you realise his capabilities are pretty, you know, impressive. He's got a great engine, a great physiology, but he chooses to use that in quite an unusual way, being a, you know, a stage hunter, and that's, you know, some of the people that carve out the best careers for themselves in professional cycling do so because they find something that they're good at, and they really focus on that.
Yeah, and I think he said the strike rate, 3 wins for every 26 breaks that he goes in. So what's that work out at? One win.
It's funny, isn't it? Because the impression you have is that his strike rate is very, very high.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's not.
He's you know, he's trying a lot to get it, and it's not coming off. Adam mentioned the comparison with Steve Cummings, which I think is good. And again, we tend to remember Cummings' wins and think that guy's clinical. You know, he just knows how to read a race. But what we don't remember, of course, is all the times he's tried and failed. So a lot of parallels between those two. Both quite idiosyncratic, maverick. Both like to ride at the back quite a lot. And again, you know, as we've said a few times, he's sort of in the right team, isn't he? A team where he's given a bit of freedom and allowed to pursue his own very individual goals. So, yeah, a really interesting chat that, and I really enjoyed listening to it. We should say a big thanks to Adam Blythe for doing these 6 interviews. Let us know what you've made of them all. Tell us your favourites. Hopefully we can return with a season 2 of the Adam Blythe interviews if he's up for it.
Well, let's hope so.
We should say cheerio as well, Lionel, get ourselves ready for the Giro.
We should indeed, yes. Next stop. Who, out of the pair of us, who's going to win the most stages?
And that's a really difficult question to answer. I think it's going to be a very close run thing. Maybe we'll be reporting on a Thomas de Gent stage win. Who knows? Could happen. Let's leave it for now. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Jonathan Rowe.